My training is in experimental psychology. I'm a cognitive scientist, so I do research on how we as human beings think and reason about the world. And I became interested in education during my PhD and started to think about how the work that we were doing in cognitive psychology might impact what we think about education. There are lots of different ways that psychologists have an impact in education. You've probably heard of fields like educational psychology, which is slightly different from what I do. That would be that's usually a career that requires postgraduate training, but it would be doing things like assessing kids on maybe learning difficulties or even kids who are doing exceptionally well and providing plans for helping kids with learning difficulties. So there's that sort of quite one-to-one sort of bit. There are other psychologists have been thinking about working collaboratively with educators and designing new ways of teaching and learning. And then there are some people who are doing things that are maybe a little bit more like classic psychology. And what I thought I'd do today is give you a little bit of classic psychology with a bit of application, just so that you can see how closely some of the areas of psychology are actually aligned to some things that educators think are important. So I'm going to cover kind of two areas. One, quite an old classic study, and another one, a very recent paper that is a big summary of a large number of studies that maybe, especially for the students in the room, might be useful because it will be a little bit about what kinds of revision techniques actually work. So, you know, some real world application as well. Right, so we're going to try. There are only a few of you, so I'm going to make you be one condition instead of the three different ones. But I'm going to put you into one condition from a classic psychology experiment. And I'm just going to give you this little booklet. If it has writing on it, it's because it's been written on by a previous group in the past, so ignore what they've done. Just for now, keep the booklet closed. And if you have a spare piece of paper, great, but if you don't, you can just think of these bits in your mind. I won't collect your responses, I promise. Okay, so what we're going to do is I'm going to read to you in a moment a paragraph, and I'll explain to you the steps with your little booklet. The real experiment was conducted in a psychology lab under much better conditions. This is just for fun, so you can get a sense of what some psychology experiments might be like that you might not have heard of yet. And what I'm going to have you think about as you participate in this experiment is how well you understand the paragraph I'm about to give you. And then I'm also going to ask you how well you remember what comes from the paragraph. So it's a bit of a memory experiment for you. Okay, so this is the bit where I have to cheat and turn off the computer because this way I can read the text and you don't get to see it. Okay, so here's the paragraph. I want you to try to remember as much from it as you can. The procedure is actually quite simple. First, you arrange items into different groups depending on their makeup. Of course, one pile may be sufficient depending on how much there is to do. If you have to go somewhere else due to lack of facilities, that is the next step. Otherwise, you're pretty well set. It's better not to overdo any particular endeavor. That is, it's better to do too few things at once than too many. In the short run, this may not seem important, but complications from doing too many can easily arise. A mistake can be expensive as well. The manipulation of the appropriate mechanism should be self-explanatory, and we need not dwell on it here. At first, the whole procedure may seem complicated. Soon, however, it will become just another facet of life. It's difficult to foresee any end to the necessity for this task in the immediate future, but then one never can tell. So I'll have you open your booklet to the first page. And the first question that you'll have that is as accurately as possible, sorry, second page, is to think about how difficult you thought this paragraph was. And maybe you've learned something ironic about it that you didn't expect when you heard the paragraph. So my guess is you might not have remembered a whole lot of it. And it's a strange little experiment that goes all the way back to the 70s. And you were in one experiment where you heard the paragraph, and then you were told it was about washing clothes. Other people were in a different condition in the real experiment where they didn't hear at all that it was about washing clothes. Do you think you might have done better, the same, or worse than that group in remembering? So it seems like once you hear what it's about, you might be able to remember more of it.
Yeah. And all the things make sense, like it's better to do few things than too many things. Right. If you're laundry, you're not going to put it all in one machine. You kind of understand.
And so we would expect that your group would do better than a group that didn't hear about that at all. A third group heard before they heard the paragraph that it was about washing clothes. What would you expect from them? They would do maybe the best. So it would seem like that group would do the best, your group would be in the middle, and then the people who would hear nothing at all about washing clothes would be at the bottom. Of course, yes. So that depends on individual differences with students, which is a really important element. Okay, so what Bransford and Johnson did, so this is fun bit of psychology is we like data, but I'll explain what it means, is the green bar is how many items they remembered correctly. These were the people who had no topic at all. These were the people who got the topic after the paragraph like you did, and these are the people who did the topic before. And despite our typical intuitions, your group did no better than the group that didn't have it at all. Because it's really hard once you have the context to kind of go back and try to recreate. So it seems like it makes more sense, potentially, but it doesn't by comparison. They also did the comprehension, which was that difficulty score that you gave. And again, your group and the group that gets no information is, they're both doing equally kind of worse than the group that gets information before. So they conducted another experiment because what might matter is the context, right? So how much information do you have about washing clothes? That might matter. So for this one, we're just going to all look at the paragraph. I'll read it out loud, but you'll get to have a look at it. This was the one we just saw. So what happened is people saw either no picture or they saw one of these two pictures first. One of the pictures was misleading content where the other picture was appropriate. So the idea was, what's the difference between getting no information at all, getting inappropriate information, so this might be if you don't really understand what washing clothes might be, or getting the right kind of information. So Okay, so this is the story that goes with it. If the balloons popped, the sound wouldn't be able to carry, since everything would be too far away from the correct floor. A closed window would also prevent the sound from carrying, since most buildings tend to be well insulated. Since the whole operation depends on a steady flow of electricity, a break in the middle wire would also cause problems. Of course, a fellow could shout, but the human voice is not loud enough to carry that far. An additional problem is that a string could break in the instrument, and then there could be no accompaniment to the message. It's clear that the best situation would involve less distance. Then there would be fewer potential problems. With face-to-face contact, the least number of things could go wrong. So if you've seen the slide, the appropriate slide beforehand, then it's potentially might have an impact on how well you remember information from this particular story. So this is their results. There's an additional bar here. So these are the people who had no information at all. These are the people who had context afterwards, kind of like in the first study. These are the people who had the inaccurate context, and these are the people who had the appropriate context. And what's interesting, again, is that this group does no better than the other two. So this led John Bransford, and later on a chap called Dan Schwartz, to start talking about the idea in terms of when we're teaching students information, it's the way we present it matters, that's a no-brainer. But when we present it might matter as well. And so they call this a time for telling. Which is, I have my remote, there we go. So this is my favorite quote from their 98 paper, which is, when telling occurs without readiness, the primary resource for students is to treat the new information as ends to be memorized rather than as tools to help them perceive and think. And what Bransford and Schwartz thought is that good context, where you have the right information, and when you have it before you actually start to hear a lot of stuff, it helps you actually make sense of the stuff you're about to learn. And that paragraph that I first exposed you to in the very beginning, for many students, if you're learning something complicated, it doesn't matter what it is, it can sound just like that. It's kind of a bunch of gibberish. And that it's really important to have some practical experiences before you get lectured on it, what does it mean, and that sort of thing. Maybe all of these strange terms that come about with learning. So this is one area where psychology has had a bit of an impact on educational practice and thinking about maybe the structure of how we might want to teach information. So basically then, this means that telling, which is that lecture stuff that might actually be an important part of learning, is really only most effective when we're ready to acquire that new information and after we've had a chance to do some stuff on our own, after we've had a chance to think about it a bit on our own. Now, washing clothes, my hope was that you might have at least some experience with what it means. And then you said, oh yeah, once I heard it, then I started to remember the things that were in the story and they started to make more sense because you had a bit of information from your own experiences that you could make sense of. And what Bransford and Schwartz have done some additional work in this thing they call contrasting cases, which is setting up in a school environment those opportunities to be exposed to something. So there might be something that a teacher wants a student to learn, and that student may not have had any experience with that before in their lives, and there might be important for a teacher to set up some opportunity to try stuff out before they're told what they should think. Okay, so a team of cognitive scientists very recently, in January of this year, published a very long article looking at what they called learning techniques, but revision techniques is what you're used to, so that's the term we're going to use. And they looked at which ones seem to work across the board in terms of, you know, do they work when we study them in a psychology lab? Do they work when we look at them in different kinds of educational contexts? Do they work for different kinds of subject areas? So one thing might work in English, but not in history or not in biology. So they were trying to look at which kinds of revision techniques are actually most effective across the board. And they looked at 10 different ones. So I'm going to, this is a little bit small, but I thought the table was nice because it was a nice little summary. I'll talk about each of those 10 and just give you a sense of what that means. So the first one they looked at was this idea of elaborative interrogation. And basically, it's generating an explanation for why some sort of fact or concept is true. So you're really trying to think critically about something and then generating an explanation for why. Self-explanation is basically explaining how what you're seeing now, this new bit of information you're learning, might be related to what you already know, or explaining the steps that you've taken in solving some sort of problem. So if you're doing a complex maths problem that involves lots of steps, being able to explain those various steps. Summarization is writing summaries of some sort of text that you're looking at. highlighting and underlining is you know, using a highlight marker and choosing some things that you think are most important, or underlining is the same sort of thing. Keyword mnemonic is trying to use keywords or some sort of mental imagery to help you remember something. Imagery for text is trying to create mental images for things that you're reading or listening to. The distinction between 5 and 6 is that 5 is really about something that's a key element, and 6 is about doing this as an ongoing task. Rereading is just as it is. It's you've read it once, read it again. Practice testing is taking some sort of practice test. So actually, you know, putting yourself in a testing situation. Distributed practice is having a schedule where you practice activities over an extended amount of time. So the distinction, you can have massed practice, which is cramming for exam the night before, or distributed practice is doing a little bit every day for the weeks or days before the exam. And then interleaved practice is mixing things up a bit. So not just focusing on one kind of problem, but when you're revising, you're thinking about different kinds of problems that are relevant within that topic area. What did I do? I've got them in the wrong order, I think. Sorry. That almost gave them away. Oh, do you know what I've done? Well, let's do it this way. So these are the different contexts in which they tested these 10 different techniques. So they had lots of different kinds of materials. So things like science definitions, different textbooks, mathematical concepts. They had different kinds of learning conditions. So open versus closed book practice, direct instruction, that someone's lecturing at you. Discovery learning is what we talked about before, which is just doing stuff on your own, rereading, practice tests. Different student characteristics, which is something I didn't talk about too much, but that's something we think is potentially important in learning. And then different kinds of tasks that you might be doing. So you might be doing free recall is an essay. So you're given a question and you have to remember a bunch of stuff. Cued recall is usually a multiple choice test. This can also be fill in the blank. And recognition is multiple choice, and then like maybe a problem solving sort of thing, extended essay writing. So they tried to look at these 10 different revision techniques across different contexts to see which ones have a consistent, seem to be effective consistently across different conditions. Okay, so the best bit, I think, from reading this, which is I hope that you might go back to some of your friends and tell them that maybe they should rethink their revision techniques, is that two things that students use very frequently are actually ineffective across a wide variety of contexts. And that's highlighting and underlining, which you said some of your friends do massive amounts of, and rereading. Which rereading seems like, well, maybe that should help because I didn't understand it the first time, but if I reread it, maybe I'll get it the second time. Two others that seem kind of effective, but not across a variety of situations, were the keyword mnemonic and summarization. And that's kind of surprising because that's something we do a lot of as well. But it doesn't seem to have kind of a robust advantage across different contexts. So some contexts it works well, for some students it works well, but it doesn't have a nice generalizability. And these are the things that do very well. And the one at the top does the best by far. So distributed practice is this doing little bits across a long period of time. Retrieval is testing. So if you want to do well in a test, practice doing the test. There are a group of cognitive scientists in the US, mainly the author who does the summary here, who's Roddy Rodiger, who's built a career on actually how you learn by doing tests. If I'm honest, my bias is I don't really like exams, but we live in an education system that requires them. And he might say the same thing. But what is quite interesting is just by being in a testing situation, you kind of consolidate your memory of things, and it actually helps you. Even if you did nothing else, it actually helps you remember more things, which is kind of interesting. It could be there's some research about, you know, when you take an exam, you get a little bit anxious. Some people get a lot anxious. And there's kind of a sweet spot for anxiety. If you're not anxious at all, you won't prepare because there's no drive to get you to do it. If you're too anxious, you'll be so anxious you won't be able to focus. But if you're somewhere in the middle, and that depends on individuals, but if you're at that point where you're just anxious enough to keep yourself going, that there's potentially something that might, that's releasing neurotransmitters in the brain that might actually be helping you consolidate memories. So it's not just the repeated exposure to the information, but there's potentially something about, oh wait, I'm in a testing situation that may make your mind more focused, and then that helps you remember that information later. Possibly, it's still unknown. That's still, maybe 10 years from now we'll have a good answer. Interleave practice is mixing things up, so don't just do, if you're doing math, don't just do one kind of computation in one session, but mixing things up. It's probably true of other contexts. Math is an easy one for me to identify, but it's just not always thinking that each study session has to be on one thing, but you're mixing bits up. Elaborative interrogation is that answering why. So this seems to work more than summarization. So it's kind of going deep into what's going on here, not just summarizing it. And that's where I said potentially with mind maps, it might work if you're using the mind maps in a certain way. So if you're using them to where you're using it to explain why something works or to explain how something happens, then that potentially gets you elaborative interrogation. But if you're only doing it as a picture, it doesn't. And then the last one is self-explanation. And I think elaborative interrogation and self-explanation, they overlap quite a bit. But self-explanation is similar in terms of reminding yourself how does the process work, and also reminding yourself kind of what you know now and how that's different from something you're about to learn, and comparing this new stuff to what you've already been exposed to. So I you've probably been hearing about these director of studies people. So I'm a director of studies for education at my college, which is Gonville and Keyes. But I also do director of studies for Emmanuel College as kind of an external person. So if you want to talk about either of those colleges, I'm quite happy to talk about those. And then what did disappear was my little logo for my lab group, which I always like to talk a little bit about because I seem like I'm in a strange place being an experimental psychologist and being interested in education. So I have a little group of undergrad and postgrad students as well as PhD and full-time researchers who are part of a group called Instruct, which is implementing new student and teacher resources using cognitive theory is where that came from. And that's exactly what we do is to kind of think about this intersection between cognition and education. And it's one way in which psychology has an impact.